Yes, good. That's all.
Actually, that's probably good.
Okay, good afternoon. I'll call to order meeting the State Government Budget Division for February 11th, 2009. We do have a quorum present. Today, we're going to be looking at the Department Administration, and as members will note, we have a lot of pages in here for the various things the Department Administration does, so we've got quite a number of people who are going to be talking about various aspects. So, Commissioner, welcome back before the Budget Division, and you'll need to identify yourself for the record again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Dana Badgerow, the Commissioner of Administration. You all remember I was here a few weeks ago talking about the actually largest part of our budget, our internal service funds, and what we'll cover today are our general fund base as well as the change items in the governor's budget, as well as a potpourri of additional topics that I think you may have an interest in. Well, let me just start talking about our budget and the budget reductions that we contribute to the governor's budget. You know that we're a creation of statute in large part. Many of our obligations are statutory, such as administering the data practices laws, managing the procurement for all state agencies. We also perform internal services for state agencies. So when we set about looking at our budget, I can't call it truly a zero-based budget, but it was a form of zero-based budgeting. We've cut our budget, as I show you a little bit later, 35% over the last 8 years. So we're down to bare bones, as I think many agencies are. So we actually looked at every single general fund activity and created spreadsheets for that activity that listed what does that activity do and what are the general fund dollars associated with it. So we broke apart our general fund areas. Just to give you an example, in the data practices area, we allocated certain costs to the issuance of opinions. We allocated certain costs to the preparation and support of the legislature, and so on. And so each of our activities we looked at in terms of what can we stop doing, which of these general fund individual or discrete activities can we not any longer do. And it was really, as you can imagine, a very tough decision, but it did result in our budget reductions, which I'll talk about just in a minute. The very first page of your handout talks about our basic budget principles. What are sort of our ground rules for reducing our budget? And obviously, first is something statutorily required. And if so, we figured it was probably pretty difficult to eliminate that unless we could imagine that the statute could be modified. One big issue we have is if we stop doing an activity, more than likely the agencies will have to pick it up and do it themselves less efficiently. Just examples of that are recycling. We could certainly terminate our central recycling operation, but agencies who I'm sure all want to recycle would then enter into their own contracts or their own processes for recycling at, I'm confident, greater cost and less efficiency. Lease negotiations, for example, if we ceased negotiating private sector leases for our agencies, we would leave that task to the agencies who don't have lease experts more than likely on their staff, and so the results, I think, would be considerably less effective. So the question is it even practical to shift the activity to another agency like the central delivery of mail? Each agency would have to go literally to the central mail repository and pick up their own mail every day, which probably isn't efficient. We did look at whether activities could be performed more effectively by private sector partners. And a couple that we looked at, but one in particular, we looked at our recycling operation. There are many firms who do recycling for large companies around the state, and so we looked at what would be the cost trade-off, what would be the differential if we were able to outsource our recycling operation. And for several reasons, it actually continues, we believe, to be more economical to manage that in-house, not the least of which is that we return money to the general fund for our sale of the materials that are recycled. We returned just over $100,000 to the general fund this last year. So when you net that out and you look at current pricing that is available on state contract for recycling activities, we continue to be a better deal by performing that in-house. But it is something that we're going to be continuing to look at. Another would be, does it improve customer service? A lot of what we do is aimed at the whole enterprise, at making the whole enterprise more efficient and effective, such as our drive to excellence or our lean activities. So those are the screens against which we looked at every single one of our activities and looked to see could we answer these questions affirmatively, and if so, in most cases, it was either exempted from reductions or it received a smaller reduction. The next chart is the traditional pie chart. I always show it to you. It's only to put in context the fact that I'm really only talking about $12 million here today out of our total budget. It's 7% of the total dollars that we use to manage the Department of Administration. And then, as I mentioned before, when you look at our department since 2001, and you look at it on an apples-to-apples basis, and let me explain what that means, our department has gone through a number of, has morphed, actually into quite a smaller organization, because a number of our activities have been spun off to other agencies. The entire Office of Enterprise Technology used to be in the Department of Administration, so we've actually neutralized the effects of those moves in this budget. So if you take our current existing activities and go back to 2001, we've had a 35% reduction in our current activities. And in some cases, obviously, we are taking on more and more responsibility that we did not have in 2001. So it's a testimony, I think, to our both our ability to manage more efficiently, but also evidence of the reductions that all agencies have had to go through. So when you look at our change items, which is the next page, we took I'm going to discuss them in order, of course, the reductions first, and then I will have staff here who will go one by one through the positive change items. But let me talk about our reduction, which is $776,000, about 7% of our budget. There are really five basic items in our reduction, the first of which appeared in the Pioneer Press this morning, talks about the move of the Environmental Quality Board out of the Department of Administration. But in effect, our part of that is the reduction by 1.5 full-time equivalents, or $140,000. It is our understanding that PCA believes that they can operate the activities of the Environmental Quality Board with fewer people, and that enables this reduction to be taken. The second one is reducing, it's a little bit worded a little bit strangely here, but it's reducing or adjusting our administrative costs that we're charging to our non-general fund activities. As in any organization, you want to make sure that your overhead is allocated appropriately and fairly, and we discovered that some items of overhead were not being charged at all or not being charged sufficiently to some of our non-general fund activities. Just to give you an example of that, my time was not being charged to our cooperative purchasing venture, and certainly as of late, I've been spending a lot of time on the cooperative purchasing venture, and so we allocate a very, very small part of my time, parts of the HR and the finance activities to these non-general fund activities so that they bear their fair share of the general overhead activities. And that actually resulted in our ability to cut the general fund by almost $237,000. We did go through some general reductions. Bits and pieces were taken out of several budgets that total up to $100,000. We did reduce recycling at the end of the day, and we were able to do that because we had a position that came vacant, and we're operating fairly effectively today with that vacant position. And so we decided that we would be able to continue to operate by simply not filling that position. Now, this is more than one position. It also means that we will not be in the future replacing some of the recycling receptacles, the big barrel ones that are not the ones you have in your offices, but the ones that then collect and aggregate. We're going to count on those lasting as long as we possibly can. And then finally, I've talked a lot about our lean program. I talked about it the last time I was here. It has been really incredibly effective. We have now trained over 100 lean facilitators out in state agencies as well as at Minsky and U of M. These are facilitators that are now out doing lean project improvement processes. We have one, our grants person isn't here today because she's actually working with another agency to lean out or do a Kaizen improvement event on their grants process. So we front-end loaded this program with some consulting assistance, and in the next biennium, we believe that it can be sustained without that consulting assistance. There's also a small staff reduction in our lean activity, but basically we're not cutting out by any means the lean activity. We will maintain a strong focus on it, but we believe that it is now dispersed enough into the agencies that we will not have any longer an outside consultant kind of guiding us and helping us with that program. So that's the sum total of our $776,000, and maybe I should just pause there.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I've heard that the payback for recycling right now is really dropped, like for aluminum, and then it's almost getting difficult to get rid of paper and it's stockpiling in some of the recycling centers. Have you noticed that, and how is that going to impact your program?
Well, it will impact the return to the general fund for sure. The numbers I have are really startling. We were getting a $260 a ton for white ledger paper, and it dropped almost $100. So now we're down around $160 a ton for the pure white paper. It's even more dramatic for mixed ledger, that which we're not able to sort, which, again, is a word, if to the extent that you can sort your good white paper from the colored, it really helps us out a lot. But if it is mixed, we only now get $1.25, whereas we used to get $41. So it is a steep, incredible decline. That will affect the amount that we're returning to the general fund, at least as long as this price, these prices hold.
Commissioner, you know, could you just the slide again doesn't tell it all. It says reduce salaries and expenses. Obviously, you cannot reduce people's salaries and so forth. Are these just, again, positions that are not being filled, or how would you describe that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can actually go through them in detail if you like, because they're little bits and pieces, as
I
mentioned.
Is that later on in your presentation?
No, it's right here. I'll do it right now.
Sure.
That's all right. Actually, there's a half of an FTE in our real estate and construction services. We've had difficulty filling the position, and so the decision has been made to save half of the money from the position to contract that service out, and simply then giving up the remainder of that salary. So it is salary savings from a position that we have not been able to fill. We are saving enough money back, as I mentioned, because we will need the service and it will have to be contracted. There are very, very small cuts in LIMIC and the EQB supplies, $12,500 each. The demographics center, another piece of the demographer, as we all know, is taking a small cut of $10,000. It is 0.09 of an FTE, which is a part of a part-time employee. And then materials management is taking a $15,000 reduction in their computer services and supplies. So supplies, services, and positions held open would be the basic summary.
Thank you. Any other questions about the presentation so far? Please proceed.
All right, Mr. Chair, then I want to go into the requests for additional money from the governor's budget. And the first, I'm going to ask Nikki Giancola to come to the table and talk to you about a Drive to Excellence project, our real property system, which you did fund in the last biennium.
Which page is this on, by the way?
It would be your next page, page 7.
As far as the budget books. Page 16 of the budget books. Yeah, we do want to look at the budget books, too, in addition to you.
Yes, and we will keep them in order of the books so that you.
You
can follow them.
That helps. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nikki Giancola. I'm an assistant commissioner in the Department of Administration. And I'm going to provide a few comments about the Drive to Excellence Real Property Project. The Department of Administration, together with 19 other agencies, has been working on the development of a real property system. It's called Arquebus since 2007, and that's when the legislature appropriated $2.5 million for the initial implementation. In addition to that appropriation, though, state agencies contributed an additional $1.825 million in carry-forward funds at a critical time last year in the development of the system. Important foundational work has been accomplished, and we project that by June of this year we will have implemented fully the first six modules of functionality, and I'll just list them off for you. It's space management, building operations, fixed assets, moves, adds, changes, facility condition assessment, and project management. Although future operating expenses were identified and requested in 2007, no funds were appropriated for ongoing system maintenance and operation at that time. This request is for a base budget addition of $844,000 a year for the fiscal year 10 and 11 biennium, and that is to maintain the system at a minimal lights-on level to protect the state's investment, as well as to continue the direction that was established in the governor's executive order number 0506. Ongoing support for the system is critical to the state's ability to manage real property with an enterprise view rather than the conventional practice of doing it as we were, agency by agency. The statewide repository of data will provide all levels of Minnesota's management with new and improved information about Minnesota's real property, improvement in the management of our facilities, and reduce the cost of maintaining state facilities. Just I'll review real high level some of the benefits with online preventive maintenance, and that is part of this building operations and fixed assets modules. Minnesota will evolve from an expensive and reactive on-demand response to more orderly, planned, and cost-effective facilities maintenance. Over time, sound preventive maintenance will reduce pressure on capital budgets by extending the life of facilities and equipment. In the area of purchasing, we believe that a single version and a common source of real property information will increase the state's ability to aggregate building-related needs for goods and services and leverage volume purchasing on state contracts. In the area of space utilization, through better decisions regarding space, the state could anticipate, we still believe, an estimated 6% reduction in leased space with corresponding cost savings in operating expenses. In the area of inventory control, better inventory management will reduce the need and cost for stockpiling spare and replacement parts. And finally, and this might be one of the most compelling incentives of all, it's the retention of knowledge. We have hundreds, we probably have thousands, actually, of building operators and managers within state agencies that are responsible for facility management. Capturing and retaining the state's vast amount of facilities-related intellectual knowledge will save countless hours of training, retraining, and information search time. We just can't afford to let that knowledge vanish as these folks retire or leave. So in order to continue the initiative and realize the value of not only the initial investment, but ongoing improvements in how we manage facilities, it is necessary to fund now the subscription support and maintenance of the Archibus application. Specifically, the funding will provide for renewal of the Archibus subscription and that software subscription and maintenance in the amount of $288,000. It is to provide for system hosting services from OET, including software and hardware maintenance, network management, security, disaster recovery, application monitoring, and application backup and recovery services, and that's in the amount of $448,000. And then finally, it's to retain the human resources. I'll say human resource. It's one personnel, a system administrator for stewardship of the application and data, and that's in the amount of $90,000. I guess I'll end with comments here. What you, in addition, have are some slides just showing some of the functionality of the system. The first one you have is space designation. This is actually a space depiction of the Freeman Building. Call this CAD drawings, computer-aided design drawings, and they are the fundamental piece, the baseline piece of the system. With that, you get a basis for accurate space chargebacks. It's an enormous help to all facility managers in move management. It allows you to have a quicker recovery time when you have disasters. I know that the Department of Human Services folks relied heavily on the data that was in Archibus when they had a sprinkler pipe break here within the last year. They were able to very quickly go online, see where there were vacancies, and they were able to accommodate over 100 additional people into the space just by having a visual of where people were and what was vacant. It gives you an accurate depiction of your egress out of space, provides an accurate calculation of occupancy and vacancy rates. It can even help you improve your bids by being able to give consultants and contractors a visual of the space that you're talking about. And I will just note that administration has been using this system for a number of years now, and that the vacancy rate on the Capitol complex right now is currently under 1%, and I believe it's due to the capability of the information in the system. The second slide that you have is kind of a triage of three things. It's the reporting functionality of the system. It's one snapshot is a PM schedule. That's preventive maintenance schedule assignment by equipment. It shows the inventory, your fixed assets, if you will, the location in the building. That goes back to the space module. And it assigns a preventive maintenance routine, which is part of the building operations module, that automatically calculates for building operators their preventive maintenance schedule. I'll just make a point here. If you don't perform PMs, your on-demand work is driven up accordingly, and planned scheduled work is in almost every case more cost-effective than the emergency breakdown type of response to repair. The second piece of this slide here is work order on-time completion tracking. That is critical for performance management. The graphic that you see is actually from our plant management division, but this would be representative of any agency's capabilities once they're fully online on the system. You can't see this, but in fiscal year 07, when we weren't showing data in this way, not 1 month hit the mark of our 90% completion rate. In fiscal year 08, we saw a very different result. By August, we were at target, and we've maintained that ever since. And I believe that that's just evidence of what gets measured gets done. And I think I'll leave it at that. There's a lot on this slide, but it's just representative of the capability of the system. Once you have the data in it, you can do many, many things with it, including a lot of this performance management. The last slide that you have in is called Real Property System Reporting. Again, I realize that that is kind of small print for you, but it is facility incident reporting. And this is another one that's very critical for performance management. Tracking your near misses is absolutely key to avoiding the bigger service-affecting outages. And so right now in plant management, we are using this tool. It is part of the Arquebus system. It's a way to track problems with equipment, and it's also a way to capture the corrective action that you've done for learning and for, again, performance management.
Thank you, Ms. Jinkle. I do have a question or two, and then I'm looking at page 18 of the budget books here, under your section. As I understand, well, first of all, it's new money we're talking about. So I think that's going to draw attention, you know, anywhere for anybody who wants to know what that is. And as I understood your testimony, most of that new money would go to under services, and that would be OET services, the computer management. I mean, if you don't have that, none of this can happen. Is that basically what your testimony is?
Mr. Chair, that's essentially it, yes.
Okay. And, you know, ultimately the question is going to be saying, well, what if we just didn't do it this year and just pushed it off? Where are we at then?
It's kind of a hard line, Mr. Chair, but okay. Where we're at is it would force agencies to revert back at minimum to whatever system they were on. We've got agencies that were managing property on Blue Line. We have agencies that were managing it in access databases. We have agencies that were managing it with other than Arquebus-related PM software. And then we have four large agencies that were using Arquebus. Without the ongoing maintenance of the system, there is no way to host it at OET. There is no way to fund a system administrator to keep the standards in place so that all agencies are following standards so that once we roll up information, we can be sure that it's based on consistent and standard data. Essentially, the enterprise system, as we're developing it here, would be lost. And that's in addition to the lost or sunk cost of the over $4 million that we've already put into the system. This is bare minimum. This isn't any new functionality that we're requesting. It's no additional personnel. The agencies will still be responsible for gathering, verifying, and inputting their own data for facilities. And it really is just to keep the lights on, to host it, and to keep our Arquebus subscription current.
As I say, at some point, as the budgets are all pulled together, I'm sure I'm going to be asked questions at some point down the road saying, well, wait a minute, you know, everybody's getting these cuts, and here's some new funding in here, so I guess we need to make sure we fully understand, you know, what the proposal is and the consequences. But any other questions about this, about the real estate, the facilities issue? Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might just summarize,
sure,
I've described it this way. You will, if it is not funded beyond July 1,
right,
what you will have is a very elegant snapshot of what the state owns on July 1. It will not be usable for any further purpose. It will have cost you $4.3 million, and it will date on July 2nd. It will be out of date. So I think in order to get the utility of the $4.3 million that has been invested, this is really needed. And quite frankly, it should have been included in the TAILS when the system was funded in the first place.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm going to cover the Office of Grants Management because I mentioned Kristen Batson is off doing a lien process here today. I just want to simply say that this is another Drive to Excellence project. It is also in response to Office of Legislative Audit findings against many state agencies for their practices in administering grants. There was, before the office existed, no consistent or disciplined set of policies as to how grants should be managed. They were sometimes managed as contracts, but not always. And so, in other words, this office was created. It has now been in existence for about a year and several months.
Well, and by the way, this is on page 13 of the budget books, too. So, thank you. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It is staffed by one person. It was funded in the current biennium only for the first year. And in the second year, there was a formula devised, quite frankly, over in the House of Representatives to charge a small amount to all state grants, 7,000 state grants totaling $1 billion, in order to fund this salary, which agencies, quite frankly, found impractical and also found it difficult in light of federal restrictions and so forth. So agencies came forward in the second year of the biennium because they believed so strongly that this office needs to exist and funded it for the second year of the biennium. But all agencies now are going through cuts. And so what we're simply asking is that this office, which I think is essential to our effective operation of grants, be funded in the base as a continuing activity. I can talk a lot about what they've done. I think on the next page it talks about the fact that it is governed, as are all DRIVE projects, by a multi-agency governance committee. We have now issued the 13 first-ever statewide policies on how grants shall be administered, with things like grants must be in writing, conflict of interest policies must be enforced, grants must all be monitored, and financials must be obtained from all grantees, and so forth. In addition, and I think you'll see this on the next page, page 13, we have two websites that have been created by this office, one of which is an external-facing website so that members of the public and nonprofits can go at any given time and search this website for available state grants. They can search by keyword, they can search by agency, and they can find whether or not there might be any grants available at any particular time on a subject such as child care. The second website is an internal-facing website, and it's intended to train and inform the hundreds of people that we have in state agencies today who are administering grants. Some of them may only administer one grant a year. It's only they manage their program otherwise, but they're not experts in grants, and this is intended to inform them better as to how they can manage their grants. In addition, this office is providing training. It has so far trained now over 150 people in a variety of grant practices. Finally, I think this is really important in our, I think, renewed emphasis on internal controls. This provides a point of contact for citizens and others who may have issues with grants. It is an ombudsman, in effect, for people who have a complaint about potential fraud or abuse or other improprieties with respect to grants. And now complaints, in fact, have been received by this office. So I think it performs a very important function. Finally, it is Kristen is out doing lien facilitation, so helping other agencies improve their grant processes. I've said it is the best bargain in state government. It is the salary of one person plus some miscellaneous expenses of $125,000.
Commissioner, the legislative auditor, of course, found numerous problems with grants in the past because there was no oversight. Nobody was tracking anything. Do you think that this has basically resolved a lot of those problems by having this?
Mr. Chair and Senators, I think it resolves about 90% of the issues. If you were to ask the legislative auditor, I know that they're very, very pleased with this office. And Kristen works really hand in glove with the auditor on the development of these policies, for example. But the one piece that probably isn't yet satisfied is that I believe the audit report referred to some internal audit functions and the internal audit and actually affirmative examination of some of our audits. And with one person, we're really not capable of doing that.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Badgero, I'm sorry she's not here because it's very impressive what one person has been able to do in 2 years. So you can certainly share that with her. We hope to keep her job. Can you explain a little bit more about why it was impractical for each entity that receives a grant, you know, to pay a small fee to help fund this position?
For sure.
Well, first of all, I mean, in order to have recovered $125,000. We would actually, in some cases, be talking about a few pennies from a particular grant. And the actual cost of processing the paperwork associated with that, we would invoice the grant. They would have a receivable. It would go through their books. We would have to collect the receivable. It would have been many, many, many times just for that one transaction, just the paperwork and bookkeeping associated with that particular reduction. One alternative might have been to have included this in the statewide indirect costs, which are routinely charged to grants, but the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget also doesn't believe that that's a viable alternative for this funding. So I think the third one is obviously we want to maintain the independence of the office, and if the office is dependent upon state agencies and in particular grants for its mere sustenance, there is, I believe, some feeling that that independence is compromised.
Chair Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, but I think that there are a lot of regulatory agencies that charge the regulated entity a fee for their own regulation. I mean, could you like have a threshold where you only would pay a fee if you got more than $1 million or something in a grant? So it would cut down the number of people that would pay for it, but then it would be $25 or something.
Yeah, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I think we would still have the same issues with, you know, just the bureaucracy of making it happen. And I will also tell you that the nonprofit community is very, very adamantly opposed to this. And maybe, I mean, they could speak for themselves as to their reasons for it. I really don't want to try to speak for it, but I know that oftentimes last year when I was testifying and Kristen was testifying on this point, Marsha Avner accompanied us because they feel so strongly that that's an inappropriate way to fund the office, again, to ensure its independence. I believe that's their basic reason.
Well, that sounds like what they were saying last year to us. So, okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just feel like there are a lot of regulated entities that license fees often that will pay for regulation. I don't know if we should let this go so easily.
Mr. Chair, I can't comment except I just want to reinforce I, too, wish that Kristen Batson could have been here today because, again, she probably could give you better explanations as to why that really isn't practical. And as we go through the session and this becomes an issue of discussion, I really encourage you to hear from her on this particular point of funding.
Sure. We'll keep an open mind. Okay. Thank you.
Our next item is the in lieu of rent item, and I'm going to ask Dave Fielding to come to the table and discuss that item.
And that is what page?
Page 15.
Page 15 of the budget books, okay?
Chairman Betzel,
yes.
And members of the committee, my name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management, and I'm going to take us through a quick review of grant account. To help you in reviewing this, it was certainly helpful for me in preparing. In your package, you have a Capital Campus map, which is color-coded to help distinguish the various pieces of real estate and how we charge for them. Each biennium, there is a general fund appropriation requested from the legislature to support the maintenance, repair, and management of space and grounds that are not subject to formal lease agreements like the ones that we have with all of our state agencies. There are three subcategories within the in lieu of rent account, the largest being what we call rent waived. And on your chart there, that is in the yellow. That amounts to about 314,000 square feet, and it's spread across the Capitol for Senate, House, Historical Society, and the State Office Building, Senate, House, Legislative Coordinating Committee, Reference Library, Reviser Office, Betts Building. There's a small section down there which is housing various Vets organizations, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, VFW, and so on. The ceremonial space, which is the green, is basically the grounds. Roughly 20 monuments and memorials on those grounds, 28 acres. In addition, there's a portion here in the Capitol that is Rotunda and the North Hall, which is classified as ceremonial space. And then finally, down at the bottom of your map, although not geographically correct, is a representation of the governor's residence on Summit Avenue. All of that falls within ceremonial space, roughly 37,000 total square feet, plus the grounds. And then finally, and it's very, very difficult, I know, to see on the scale here, but there is sort of a bright blue you'll find across eight different buildings here on the Capitol campus. There are small areas, generally a couple hundred square feet at a time, which are set aside for services for the blind and for the vending operations that they perform. The request for the biennial budget is an increase in this account of $500,000 for each of the 2 years. Going back to try to view that increase and put it in context, for the period from fiscal year 02 through 09, the appropriations for facilities and grounds in the in lieu of rent account have increased by a total of 4%. And more importantly, that has remained flat with no increase since fiscal year 2004. So we've gone through three biennial cycles without any increase in that account. As I think we're all aware, during that same period of time, unit costs have increased significantly. Utility rates, for example, electricity, which accounts for over 50% of our total energy, are up by 30%. Our natural gas rates are up by over 170%. The rates for district energy for heat in that period of time are up by 86%. I went back online and checked the National Consumer Price Index over that period of time, and it was up by 23.5%. All the while, the increase for in lieu of rent has been at 4%. Now, we've been doing a lot in administration, specifically in plant management, during that time to try to hold our costs down. And I'd like to outline a couple of points for you to that end. Headcount, for example, in that period of time, we have taken a reduction of almost 15%, 33 FTEs over that period of time in two blocks in fiscal year 04 and 09. In addition, we have been working now for 2 years to strengthen our control of lost time, both in the non-FMLA, we'll consider it sick time, and also in injury lost time. Our lost time, non-FMLA lost time, now is down this year, just in the first 7 months of this year, by over 18% or over 1,500 hours through increased oversight and attention on the part of supervision and working in close concert with the union, I should say. Injury lost time for that same period of time is down almost 13% because of a renewed interest and working very closely with the safety committee and with our employees. With those reductions, we have achieved significant increases in productivity. As Nikki Giancola showed you in her display on the Archibus and how we use that information for tracking work orders, preventative maintenance work orders over the last 2 years are up by over 200% for a total last year of over 12,000 preventative maintenance work orders, and the performance against our goal of 90% was at 93.7%. On-demand work orders in that same period are up by 95%, and we achieved our standard there. We have as our number one goal this year and will for the foreseeable future the achievement of the 10% energy reduction outlined in the governor's executive order 05-16. Through the first 7 months of this year, we're down by 2.5%. This is our most difficult time of the year, obviously, and this has not been an easy winter for us. But nevertheless, we do have a savings going into the spring. We've achieved that through changes in our operating procedures, building operating schedules, and upgrades to systems, both HVAC and lighting. I think it's safe to say that without all of those initiatives, the increases that we are charging our tenants in our leases and also the increase that we're requesting today would be higher. There's really no other available funding source for dealing with the costs of maintaining, repairing, and operating these spaces. In your package also, just to give you a sense of the degree of deterioration out on our grounds, we have a series of photos that were taken last week. Photos sometimes don't really tell all, but this is just a representative set of pictures. If you've been out on the grounds in the fall, you know that our walkways, our steps, are in serious need of repair. And a very significant portion of the funds that we're asking for here will be devoted to putting those facilities right. I think it's safe to say that failure to fund this increase will impact our ability to maintain and repair these facilities to the standard that we've established for ourselves and to the expectations that I think the citizens of the state of Minnesota have for us.
Thank you, Mr. Fielding. I've got a couple of questions. You said that between 2002 and 2009 there have been a 4% increase in the cost to maintain the Capitol complex. Is that a fair statement?
Senator, that's a 4% increase in what we've charged.
Okay, charged. Gotcha.
Yes.
Charged. Okay. Now, other agencies have, you know, come before us and they've talked about, you know, some of their rents that they paid. You know, we have a different arrangement here, but has that been a comparable amount with what the other government agencies are paying as for their rent to the Department of Administration? I'm just trying to gauge what's happening with here with what's going on everywhere else. Have they had about a 4%?
Actually, Senator Betzel, no. Their increases have been significantly higher.
Okay.
I just had the numbers refreshed this morning. From the period of 2002 through this biennial increase, they will be up a little over 32%.
Okay. Now, could you explain a little bit in more detail? We have in lieu of rent, you know, as opposed to, you know, I mean, the legislature doesn't necessarily send a check over to admin. How, procedurally, how does that work when you talk about in lieu of rent?
Well, I'll have to defer to the accountants, but it's my understanding that it's an appropriation in the general fund, which is used to help fund our and cover our costs for supplies, for labor, depreciation, all the same kinds of costs that we incur in a lease with a tenant, we incur for the space that's occupied by the Senate, by the House, and others. And so this is simply the funding mechanism that we use to cover those costs.
Okay, so now, is this proposal by the governor different from what's done in the past? It looks like he's proposing sort of an offset or something taken out of the tenant's budget, which would be the governor's office, the Historical Society, and legislature, and going the money going into the general fund as opposed to going to the folks that provide the maintenance. Is this different, what he's proposing, that we've done in the past?
I believe that in the governor's proposal, he's looking for this to be budget neutral,
okay,
which case then there would need to be equal offsets coming from these various entities' budgets.
So the tenants' budgets are going to have to be reduced in order to pay for this. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not exactly sure how the legislature's budgets are crafted, but I guess it's my understanding that if I need $500,000 and it's got to be at the end of the day a budget neutral request, then the cost of operations for the legislature, for example, would need to be reduced by that like amount.
Yeah, and members, I'm looking at page 15 of the budget books. In about the middle of the page, it says, in order to provide a $500,000 increase each fiscal year for in lieu of rent and to minimize the fiscal impact to the general fund, offset amounts were allocated to the legislature, historical society, the governor's office. So it sounds like they're saying that it should come out of those particular budgets in order to pay for this. I'm just trying to make sure I understand that.
Senator, that's my understanding, yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, about a year ago or so, the sidewalks were torn up and they were running, I believe it was new steam lines around this part of the Capitol. Who paid for that?
Senator Olstein, I think you may be referring to the chilled water lines that were run across University Avenue up to the administration building, and that was paid for from the FR&R account of the administration building.
So,
Mr. Olstein.
Thank you. Is there something similar to pay for this kind of maintenance on the sidewalks and those kinds of things? Because normally, wouldn't that be out of a capital budget somewhere? Or I'm not understanding why we would be directly billed for those improvements to the ceremonial grounds.
Senator Olstein, I think we can come at that in a number of different ways. Since this is not a bonding year, we're certainly not requesting capital dollars for this, but the work needs to be completed, and this is, I think, certainly in those photo examples, this is pretty straightforward repair work as opposed to a capital improvement.
Would this $500,000 repair be done with this portion of the budget for this year then? Is that what that $500,000 would go to?
Senator Olstein, a portion of the money would go to that, yes.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I want to just clarify, if I might, Senator Olstein's question. The money that was used to make those repairs, in fact, came out of leasehold monies. Dave used the term FR&R, but that is an account in our leasehold monies, lease dollars that had been paid by the Department of Administration into a repair account. So effectively, it's the same kind of fund that we're seeking here. It would be the legislature's leasehold account if you paid rent, but you don't. So it's coming out of this generally funded pot, much as the same way it came out of the Department of Administration funds.
But if the budgets of the governor, the historical society, and the legislature are reduced to pay for this, this is basically money that goes for the general fund. I mean, the general fund is benefited. There's no direct correlation. I mean, ultimately, you know, we don't have a dedicated fund here we're talking about. I mean, ultimately, the money's going to be paid for. We might be reducing budgets that may or may not come to the amount that's offset as opposed to if we appropriated the money. If we appropriated $500,000, it has to be used for that particular purpose. If we reduce these budgets, it may or may not be used for these maintenance purposes.
Mr. Chair, if I might, it would indeed. And the in lieu and rent account is, in fact, a dedicated account for the preservation of these properties.
I see.
It doesn't go into some fungible account that can be used for the benefit of other agencies.
I see. Okay. Any other questions about in lieu of rent increase of $500,000? Nothing? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Fielding.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to then turn to our cooperative purchasing venture. We've talked about this in a couple of other hearings, and I'm going to ask Kent Allen to come forward and describe that
cooperative
proposal.
Purchase expansion, that's page 19. Okay.
It is, and if you're following along with the slides, it's page 17 on the admin slides.
We've got both budget books and the slides. Okay, go ahead.
My name's Kent Allen. I'm the director of the Materials Management Division within administration. What we're proposing is actually an adjustment to an existing program, but one that we think can yield some significant savings and efficiencies for local units of government. The program I'm referring to is Minnesota's Cooperative Purchasing Program. It's one that you've authorized under Minnesota Statute 16C.11, and it allows admin to develop contracts that could be used by local units of government, also by higher education, nonprofits, and some others. It allows us to collect fees paid by contracted vendors that are then sufficient to cover the costs of administering the program. So although we are requesting your permission to spend some money, some of the good news is that we're not having to ask for an appropriation in order to do the work involved. Historically, our program has focused on providing goods and services needed by state agencies. Contract vendors agree to it, we also allow local units to use those same contracts. And we currently have 828 contracts that we do make available to local units. But they weren't developed specifically for the local units' needs. Many of the things that local units of government buy are the same things that state agencies buy. So there's a great opportunity to sort of piggyback on the state contracts, and much of that is done. What we're proposing is that we actually focus for the first time on the unique needs of local units and try to develop contracts for them as well. And then in return, what we're suggesting is that local units would be required to consider the use of those contracts. And consider is really the key word here. We're not asking for a mandate that would impose the contracts on local units of government. If better purchasing options existed for them, they would be welcome to use those better options. If you're working through our slides, you might turn to slide 18, which talks a little, gives you a little more background on the program. The program is operated by the Department of Administration, working closely in conjunction with the Office of Enterprise Technology. They assist us particularly on technology contracts and setting technology-related standards. There's no cost for local units or other eligible parties to participate in the program, and we currently have 700 member entities. A good coverage of counties, 84 of 87 counties are participants. It starts to slide with cities, where we have 255 of 858 cities. Slides even further with townships, where we have 40 townships out of the 1,797 in the state. So although there's considerable participation in the program now, those numbers would suggest that there are some missed opportunities.
Mr. Chair?
Yep, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering how it's been marketed to local units of government. It seems that a number of them in my area are well aware of it and are using it, and yet I'm hearing that 255 out of 858 cities have never accessed it, even though it's now free. And maybe did they ever hear that you went from a $400 charge to free, or when did that happen? I'm just wondering about promoting it and marketing it.
Yeah, Mr. Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, a good question, and you raise an interesting point in that in the prior to fiscal year 09, there was a charge to become a member of the program. And we realized that we were able to cover our administrative costs without continuing that charge. And we have attempted to do some outreach and education around that, although it is a change, and we probably could do more. Our membership isn't considerably higher this year when there's no cost to join than it had been in the past when there was a fee. We go to the meetings of the associations of cities and townships and so forth and try to get ourselves out there so people are aware that the program exists. But we haven't marketed it as aggressively as we probably could.
Mr. Allen, we've sort of talked about this within this budget division, and we've used actually Senator Kubley because he comes, I think, from the furthest distance of all the members of this budget division. But why would somebody from, say, Granite Falls want to participate in the program when if they have to drive to St. Paul to get their stuff and drive back? Isn't it a lot easier to go somewhere else?
Mr. Chair, the program operates in such a way that no one would have to be driving to St. Paul to pick up their commodities. What we do is develop contracts that are available for use by contacting the contracted vendors. So St. Paul Central Procurement Office negotiates the terms and conditions and the pricing of the contracts, but we're not a direct participant to all of those contract transactions. I mean, clearly that would be an administrative nightmare and nothing that any of us would be interested in trying to make work in any effective way.
So where are their supplies then? Do they get FedEx to them, or how do they access this?
Individual contracts have different arrangements as to how materials are provided, but they certainly are made available by contracted suppliers without the Central Procurement Office being a party to that specific transaction. Every state contract has identifying information that a local unit of government could use to be informed as to who they need to contact in order to receive goods and services via the state contract. And that information is all available online to try to make that transaction as painless as possible.
Sir Coley.
Yeah, just a follow-up to that, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, I guess, so really what you're saying is that all you're asking is that they be required to use the form or to take a look at the contract as being a less costly alternative. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're correct. Yeah, so what we're proposing is that local units would look at state contract pricing before they made a decision to use another alternative.
Mr. Oblin.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, when you're purchasing and you reach a certain price break, how many price breaks are there? For example, you know, there's been talk of a mandate, especially for the school districts, and so they're saying, well, we could come in with a purchase order for, you know, a huge volume of paper supplies or whatever it is the districts are going to need. But is there a point where you get your best price after this anyway, and or can they keep discounting the bigger it is? Because I too have a few concerns about the bill that has the mandate in it, and I don't know how you purchase. So when you're purchasing, does your supplier say, well, if you purchase 850 of these computers, we'll give you this price, and if you purchase 1,600 of them, we'll give you this price? But because you don't know who's going to purchase off your site, you don't know for sure which one you're going to get. Or how do you manage that?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, in most instances, we aren't in a position where we can guarantee that a supplier will receive X number of orders by being a state contract vendor. What we do is give them historic data on what the state has purchased in the past. And to the extent that we can bring in local units of government and others as part of the prospective pool from which they'll be receiving orders, that's always advantageous to both the state and those other entities that might choose to use the contract.
So Mr. Allen, if a township in, say, northern Minnesota wants to buy a laptop computer, would they get the same price if they use this process as a township in southern Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, yes, they would, and they'd get the benefit of the fact that we've pooled the purchasing power of all state agencies and then many sort of voluntary users from the local government community and nonprofit community.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm surprised, too, by these numbers because on big ticket items like a snowplow or something, the state bid is just amazing compared to what somebody may get that bid on their own. Or like a city purchasing a four-wheel drive pickup truck under the state bid, it's the savings is tremendous. So I'm interested to see if maybe this reduction in fee may allow more cities to participate more readily.
Mr. Chair and Senator, we would hope that it will. And we would hope that our proposal here will get lots more local units voluntarily realizing that we provide a value and service that's going to save them time and money.
Okay. Senator Cooper.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Allen. I guess, you know, I know that one of the issues that local units of government think about, you know, is not only the cheapest price, but also, you know, trying to keep a business so that it's economically viable in the communities in which they live. So, you know, if you have the cheapest price and it's not significantly different, do they still have to use it then, or is there no requirement in that regard at all?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Senator, what we actually are proposing in the governor's language is that local units be required to review the cities and counties be required to review the state contract pricing and then only use the state contract in instances where it's practicable and cost effective. So we retain considerable discretion for decision making at the local level as to whether they have a more practical or better value option. And when we do, they are free and encouraged to take it.
Sir Pappas. Sorry, Sir
Colby. Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Allen. I guess, you know, part of the concern, I'm sure, that local units will think about is, you know, if you buy something that's, you know, under warranty, that kind of thing, how far are you going to have to go for service, or are service calls included in the contract? Or, I mean, you know, I don't know. There are a lot of different pieces to consider, and, you know, maybe you've already thought those through. I hope you have, and I suspect you probably have, but I know from, you know, from being here long enough that those are some real concerns for local units.
Mr. Chair, Senator, and those are valid concerns, and that's one the key reason why we were very clear in not wanting to impose any hard mandate on local units. There could be any number of very legitimate reasons to choose to buy locally, and we're not trying to interfere with that. What we're suggesting is that they look at the state contract price, and we hope and think that in many, many instances they'll find the price and the service and the efficiency of what we offer so positive that they'll take advantage of that. But again, that's not an absolute requirement that they do if they have better value alternatives.
Hey, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I just thought I would interject. We think that this is particularly an acute time for local units to be looking at opportunities to save money. And just to, by point of reference, on these state contracts, these enterprise-wide contracts that we've entered into for state agencies and all buyers have recorded an aggregate of $210 million in savings over the five-year life of these contracts. That's cost avoidance. But, the numbers here are really dramatic. They're striking, the amount of savings that we're able to obtain. On copiers, multifunction devices, for example, our savings are up to 68% lower on our new state contract for those devices than were previously available. Our savings on laptops and desktops are up to 44% less than we were previously paying. So we're just offering this in a time when we know that local units are strapped, when local government aides are under challenge. This is another way for them to find ways to cut costs in ways that don't diminish services in any way. So we think it's a great option for them. And the more we've talked with the associations and league and so forth, they're, I think, very eager to make better use of these contracts, and that's really all we're striving. I make the other point, though, is Mr. Allen identified that we do have a number of products, a whole long list of them that we know that local units will use, but there are cases where we don't. Townships, for example, 51% of their purchases are gravel. Well, we don't have a state contract for gravel. We don't have statewide specifications, and so we've pledged to work with the Association of Townships to try to develop statewide contracts, much as we have for salt and road salt, which I think many local units utilize. But we would establish a state contract for gravel so that townships could take advantage of it.
Yes, Sarah Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Allen. Does the cooperative purchasing program ever cooperate with other cooperating purchasing programs? For example, we are by statute a member of a 12-state compact called the Midwest Higher Education Compact that was created to do cooperative purchasing.
Mr. Allen. Mr. Chair and Senator Pappas, actually Commissioner Badgero and myself met with that group, what, about 3 weeks ago, to look at the issue of whether we could find some joint collaborative efforts between these two groups. So we're certainly open to whatever we believe will yield best value purchasing opportunities for government units in Minnesota. We're also now looking at, you probably have seen information in the media about Governor Plenty's encouragement of joint efforts with the state of Wisconsin. Since that request was put forward, the state of Wisconsin has actually joined the Minnesota Cooperative Purchasing Program so that the state of Wisconsin can be, in some cases, consistent with their own legal requirements using the contracts that we have established in Minnesota. So we're reviewing a number of Wisconsin and Minnesota contracts to look for ways to collaborate there and finding some good prospects.
So you're saying that this program here could have, basically, instead of the power of one state, it's two states, so that both states could benefit from the purchasing power?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
Minnesota has actually been a leader in developing a number of cooperative programs, and we operate a 45-state pharmaceutical purchasing group. We do the computer contracts with manufacturers on behalf of a national association of procurement state agencies. So, yes, there's potential for cooperative programs and the value of aggregated savings across state lines.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, maybe Wisconsin could get a line on gravel.
Well, that's what the Midwest Higher Education Compact is. It's 12 states.
12 states, right.
Right, and it was formed among the higher education institutions, right. But they make their services or their joint purchasing services available to private colleges, cities, school districts, nonprofits.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add a point, if I might, and particularly in response to Senator Pappas. We are also talking with the University of Minnesota and Minsky about other opportunities where commodities are not offered by MEC and to collaborate and be able to get their volumes available under state contract as well. And I met with the chancellor, in fact, and all the heads of all 35 campuses about 2 weeks ago to discuss with them the possibilities that they could be leveraging these state contracts for some savings as well. We're not trying to compete with MEC, but there are many, many commodities that we have that MEC does not offer. So we're looking at every opportunity for savings.
Cheryl Seen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, in light of what may probably happen to LGA and community or county program aid, would you be willing to kind of do a boilerplate letter that we could maybe send to our counties and our cities within our areas and just say that this service is available and here's some of the ways you could use it?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Olstein, we are meeting with a group that is, I think, dubbed themselves as the Big Three, which is the Cities, Counties, and Townships Associations. We're meeting with them just coming up end of March. And we are, in fact, we've prepared marketing materials. I have flyers that I could make available to you. And we're anxious to get the word out even before the legislation gets passed, if it does. So,
appreciate that.
Sir Roebling.
Did I hear you mention nonprofits can get in on this too?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, certain nonprofits are eligible to use these contracts, as are private colleges. And more recently, private colleges have been coming on board and achieving some really dramatic savings on some of the commodities that they're buying.
Mr. Chair,
what
type of nonprofits typically are able to use it? Can like you said, private colleges, could private schools use it too?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, yes, they can. There are actually, I believe, four different categories of nonprofits that are defined in statute that are eligible, and it gets I'd be hard-pressed to differentiate very clearly between those four, but could certainly send you more information on the thresholds a nonprofit would need to meet to get into the program. And that's a change effective 1 year ago, 2 years ago. It's a fairly new development. It was lobbied by United Way and some other interested groups. And nonprofits, we've tried to do some outreach to nonprofits, but it would be another example of an area where there are undoubtedly entities that could benefit that aren't as aware of that opportunity as they probably should be.
Mr. Chair?
Sure, certainly.
I think Senator Olstein's comment is a good one. We often have access to media and getting the word out, you know, whether it be through columns or letters to the editor. And so it would be helpful for us to have that information so we could spread it around the state as legislators.
And I think we use the, through OET, we use the purchasing contracts for the computers, and you know that's why we're able to get different. Yeah, I mean, some members and staff want larger computers, and we were able to get a variety of them at a lower cost. Okay,
Mr. Chair, I find that I did have copies of the brochure, which we'll distribute to you.
Gotcha. Okay.
Thank you.
Further, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr. Allen. Okay.
Very welcome.
Our next topic is the Small Agency Resource Team. We call it SMART, and I'm going to ask Deputy Sheila Rieger to cover that item.
This is page 21 of our budget book.
My name is Sheila Rieger. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Administration. On page 22 of our handout is the item referred to as SMART, the Small Agency Resource Team. And this change item proposes expanding the SMART program, which provides professional human resources and financial services to small agencies, boards, and councils. And just, you may recall the SMART initiative from our last time we gathered together, but I thought I'd just tell you real briefly a little bit about why SMART was created. It was actually created in July of 07. And really, it's because the government accounting, purchasing, hiring, payroll systems, and so forth are really very complex. It takes a considerable amount of time to learn them, to be able to operate efficiently within those systems. And the small organizations, the real small boards and councils in particular, they have a hard time. They don't have the resources to have professional HR or accounting people on staff, nor do they really have the volume of work that would require a full-time or even, in some cases, a part-time staff person. So the results are, despite their best efforts, they often have difficulty with these business functions, sometimes resulting in late payments or contract violations. Inadequate controls are in place surrounding their financial matters. There's wasteful spending oftentimes, and sadly, legislative audit citations, which we see from time to time. So sharing services together, coming together by using SMART, is one way to offer these services in a really cost-effective manner. So the finance office, MMB, they recognize that there are some additional needs out there with the small organizations, and they really came to admin and requested that we put this initiative in. It's $145,000 a year, and it's for the costs associated with two additional staff people, one on the HR side and one on the financial side. They also listed four organizations as proposed recipients, and they're listed there in the materials. On the next two pages, pages 23 and 24 in the handouts, are just a partial listing of some of the services that SMART provides: hiring processes, labor relations, performance management, purchasing, etc. And then the next page is a listing of the SMART clients. Additionally, to providing these services, we put together a SMART website where we have different resources available to these customers. And we've put out two so far electronic newsletters to our customers telling them about the current HR things that are in process. For instance, let's say it's open enrollment time, tips for open enrollment. We had recent law changes related to FMLA, so we put articles together and share that information with our clients. So shared service organizations like SMART are in place really throughout private industry, and it's happening more and more in government. Meeting these essential business needs is really critical for these groups. It allows them to focus on their primary mission, and it allows their back office functions to be handled in a really secure and professional way. Helping these agencies put proper financial controls in place and to follow the policies and the rules and procedures is really good business, and in doing so in such a cost-effective way makes it even more worthwhile.
We have we've had a couple of agencies within our budget jurisdiction come before us. You know, a number of them do use SMART, some do not, and you know, of course, it's not required. I do see that there's a request for additional money for it, but at some point, either we mandate them or we say, "Well, if you're not going to use it, you're on your own." I mean, what are we supposed to be telling these agencies other than, you know, it's to their benefit to do it? I mean, you've probably talked to these same folks, too. Some just don't seem to want to do it.
Mr. Chair, members, I can't say that we've experienced that where we've had approached people and they've said we're not interested. However, as a matter of fact, as recent as Friday, I spoke with 110 different people at the financial forum that MMB put together. These were folks, executive directors from lots of small boards and councils, and I did a quick 15-minute talk about what SMART does. After that, I stayed in the room to answer any questions that were there, and I had several folks come up and talk about what an interesting program it is and the fact that they look for opportunities. For instance, we've had an instance or two where we had agencies that had a financial person, an office manager or business manager, if you will, who then retired. So they chose, instead of filling that position, to go with the SMART program to get those needs met and avoided filling that vacancy. So, I guess I can't answer that without perhaps doing more of a survey of these groups to find out where the needs are. We're getting that direction from MMB in particular.
I mean, you list as your clients the CAP board, and as I recall, they weren't using your services, as I...
Mr. Chair, they use our services on the financial side, okay, but not on the HR side.
Not the HR side, I see. So what you're asking for an increase, or the governor's proposing an increase of $145,000 per year. What is that going to allow you to do, and what happens if that money isn't provided?
Mr. Chair, members, if that money isn't provided, we will continue to operate SMART in its current capacity. We will not be able to expand, and if we have agencies that are coming forward or MMB identifies agencies that need the services, we simply won't have the resources to help them. But it will continue with the clients that we have. We get great feedback from them. They're appreciative of the services, and we have found numerous. In fact, I have lots of detailed information about the kinds of things we've been able to do to help them. So we're pleased that we will be able to keep the program running at its current level.
Okay. Any questions about the SMART program? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as with the cooperative purchasing venture, I'm happy to present the next one, which also does not require any general fund money and any incremental money. But I did want to present it because it is a significant initiative. We're calling it our Enterprise GIS Initiative, and it is a Drive to Excellence project, and there will be a legislative initiative. Legislation is currently being drafted to create this new office, the CIO, so to speak, of Geographic Information Systems. Chris Cialik is here. David Arbeit is the head of that organization, but he's out of town this week, so Cialik is here, and he will explain the program.
And apparently there is nothing in the budget proposal since there is no money proposed here.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we would utilize LIMIX funding for this activity.
Gotcha. So this is just – okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good afternoon. I would like to talk a little bit about the Enterprise GIS Initiative, which is –
You need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. My name is Chris Cialik. I am the Data Services Manager for the Land Management Information Center, LIMIC.
Okay.
I'd like to talk about the Enterprise GIS Initiative, which is a Drive to Excellence project launched last year to create a Minnesota Geospatial Information Office, an MGIO. It was approved by the Drive to Excellence Subcommittee Subcabinet in June. The MGIO is being created to provide more formal process for coordinating and guiding geospatial data and technology. This is often referred to as geographic information systems or GIS technology. It employs a strategy that moves away from agency-focused approaches and toward implementation of enterprise GIS services that support all state agencies. This initiative is designed to formalize many of the responsibilities that my office, LIMIC, has been assuming over the past 30 years, but that are not clearly spelled out in statute. A design and implementation plan, as part of the work of the coordinating committee for this effort, has been recently published just last Friday, as a matter of fact. It was developed by a consultant, an organization called Applied Geographics from Boston, Massachusetts, which worked together with stakeholders representing 20 state agencies. It identifies opportunities to transform the ways we do GIS in state government, and it provides a blueprint on how to begin implementation with options to scale up if and when additional resources become available. The report illustrates some of the benefits of moving forward with this initiative, and they include sharing data, technology, and expertise across agencies to enhance e-government opportunities, helping agencies control future costs of implementing and supporting GIS, developing enterprise-wide software licensing agreements, and creating new opportunities for agencies taking advantage of GIS. There are a number of state agencies that would like to get into the technology, but just can't afford it. The legislation being drafted to create the MGIO will direct all of the assets, staff, and equipment of LIMIC to be transferred to this new office, and the LIMIC's enabling statute will be repealed. LMIC's existing funding levels will support the new MGIO. Now, on page 26 of your handout, there is a graphic that describes some of the functionality, the activities that are intended to be part of the MGIO's mandate. According to the plan, the enterprise services will be divided up into three broad areas, and they'll contain eight different separate distinct activities. Under coordination, there'll be leadership, outreach and communication effort, data coordination, technology coordination. In the infrastructure realm, we're looking at data services and web services to be developed and implemented across state agencies. In technical support bubble, training, guidance, and project support services will be provided. Now, you may be thinking, well, what does all this mean? Under the technical infrastructure example, there are a few examples of data and web services that currently exist that might illustrate where we could go with expanding this these functions. One example within my office provides a dozen different types of digital aerial photography, and if you took a look at page 27 of your handout, you would you'd see an illustration of this. Digital aerial photography that has been collected by a variety of state and federal agencies and counties, and we make them available online through something we refer to as a geospatial image server. Now, the imagery in this service ranges from 1991 statewide photography that was supported through an LCMR project, all the way to photographs that were gathered for the Secret Service prior to the Republican National Convention just a few months ago. This type of service provides users and application developers with a quick and efficient access to a wide variety of valuable data. The use of our image server has increased 70% over the past year, which gives us a pretty strong indication that these kinds of services that provide data and access to them are really quite valuable to other state agencies, local governments, and other members of the GIS community in Minnesota. Developing additional services that focus on different themes, lakes and streams, for example, civil and administrative boundaries, transportation network, are the kinds of things that we would initiate in a new MGIO under this activity. The MGIO will be located in the Department of Administration. The governance structure will include two advisory groups, one focused on the interests of state agencies and the other focused on other stakeholders, which would include county and local governments, universities, nonprofit organizations, the private sector, and federal agencies. The office is working closely, is working in close coordination with the state's chief information officer, who has been involved in the development process since the very beginning. The budget assumes transfer of LMIC's base budget to this new office, and the implementation plan that I mentioned earlier provides initial priorities and scale-up options if available for the future. Legislation has been drafted and is currently in the governor's office.
When there were proposals to reduce LMIC's appropriation in the last biennium, the stakeholders, you know, were certainly excited about that and let us know about that. Have you gotten any feedback about this proposal from them?
Mr. Chair, we've gotten a great deal of feedback on this proposal. This has been a community effort, the development of the strategy. And as I mentioned, there are going to be two advocacy organizations that will be informing the MGIO of their desires. One will be comprised of state agency representatives, but the other will be the broader community. It will include the same people, and represent the same organizations that you heard from last session.
If draft legislation is coming, I hope it gets introduced soon. The first deadline is slightly more than a month away, so we've got to get moving.
Mr. Chair, the legislation is just in its very finishing stages, and we don't expect any issues with it.
We can't stop the clock. So, okay, any questions about this proposal? Mr. Seelick and Commissioner?
Thank you.
Okay, is Mr. Gillespie here, too?
We have Mr. Gillespie here. We don't have any presentation materials.
Okay. This pretty much concludes everything you've got.
That concludes the formal remarks, but okay. We're here to answer any questions that you might have.
Do we have anything in the budget books that we did not yet cover here? We've covered everything here. Okay, any questions of about the Department of Administration? Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Bedford, you know I've been asking about the audits of the agencies been done by the DOA, and the latest one you had was released on October 12th of 2006. And I noticed in your remarks today that you mentioned some of the findings and the steps that you all had taken to correct them. And I was wondering, there were, in this financial audit, there were seven findings, so they were significant. Ones, although I think some of them helped to deal with new programs that were coming online and just being able to work through the bugs on them. But to your knowledge, are there any of the findings from that audit that have not been reconciled at this point? And if so, can you tell me why?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, we have implemented all of the findings as we laid out in our response letters. You may remember there were certain findings with respect to the fees concerning our pharmaceutical program, and we proposed a methodology which is consistent with industry practice that would, in terms of how, to what level of accuracy do we need to compute those fees, and I believe the OLA accepted that methodology. It is not strictly what they had recommended, but it is what is practical and what is the industry standard. With that one possible exception, they have all been implemented. We know that our time is coming, however, not having had an audit since 2006. I will also mention that we've been included in other audits. We were included in the OLA audit of capital budgeting, for example, with no findings for the Department of Administration, and most recently in the one that just came out today with respect to the integrity of the financial statements, there were no findings with respect to Department of Administration.
Mr. Chairman,
this
morning in the Legislative Audit Commission, we had a program evaluation that was done on MNCOR, and one of the findings there had to do with the degree to which on their labor agreements they used purchase orders or contracts, and some explanation for that. But the legislative auditor had thought that more of the things should be contracts, even if they should be simple ones. And they were going to be reviewing the policy with regard to their purchase order things. This is like one-time things that they get this week that somebody wants next week. But I wonder to what extent, if any, has the Department of Administration given advice to or met with Mr. Pyros, I think, with regard to developing even the criteria for purchase orders so that when some sort of similar audit or something comes up again, there's going to be a rationale presented to the Office of the Legislative Auditor of that thoughtful process that was used and why some are contracts and why some are not, rather than a response like, well, it seemed a good idea at the time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, Kent Allen again. We periodically receive inquiries from Mr. Pyros at MNCOR. Historically, we've had a good working relationship with MNCOR. Mr. Pyros is somewhat new in that role, maybe 2 or 3 years, depending upon whether you consider that new. The MNCOR has some formal exceptions to the rules that most agencies need to follow and that have been approved by the legislature.
Are they in statute, those exceptions?
Some are in statute, yes, and particularly with respect to whether they need to go through the normal state bid process as it relates to the materials that they are purchasing to go into either for resale or that go into their manufacturing process. The issue of using purchase orders for work agreements with private industry was one I hadn't been aware of until I saw the summary of the OLA report this morning. And that is not something we'd been asked about and wouldn't be what we would have advised as a best practice if we had been asked.
Sarah Rust.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Allen, Commissioner, I hope you will contact them. I think they have some reasonable explanations for why they used them, but they should be laid out as a policy rather than ahead of time, rather than after the fact. So I invite you to contact Mr. Pyrus and offer your help or suggestions as they are developing their policy. I think they could benefit from talking with you guys.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'd be happy to do that. I genuinely believe that they are operating with good intentions and have some unique challenges. But I think working with us, we can help them get through some of those things in a way that satisfies the public interest.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner and Mr. Allen, the report was 90% complimentary. I mean, they are doing a pretty good job. There were a couple of things in terms of presentation of information that lacks some transparency, which they're going to take care of now. But this other issue, I think just more conversation about it, developing the policy could be continued to be very helpful in what otherwise seems to be a very good program in our correction system.
Yeah. Commissioner, did you have anything?
No, we work closely with MnCorp, and we'll be happy to help them.
Thank you. Any other questions of the Department of Administration? If not, thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much.
Members, on Wednesday, we're going to be looking at the constitutional officers, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, secretary of state, and state auditor. Next Monday, we will bring in the Office of Enterprise Technology to look at their budget issues. Tuesday, the new forecast comes out. It's our hope to have the Minnesota Management and Budget Department of Finance in on Wednesday to talk about their part of the budget, which is also going to be affected by whatever happens on Tuesday. So that's the map for the next week or so. No other questions? Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.